Hi, everybody. I'm George, and welcome to another episode of The Best Little Horror House in Philly, the show where we talk about the best horror movie ever made, according to our guest, at least. And today's guest is the artist behind the excellent Acid Nun, among other great paintings, comics, and more. Please welcome Corinne Halbert.
Hi.
Very excited to have you here, Corinne. Your work is incredible. I'm a big fan of it. My buddy A.T. Pratt introduced me to it, and it's easy to see why you two get along.
Thank you so much. And A.T. is unbelievable. I love their work. It's mind blowing. The little, You know, cutting all that out with the X-Acto blades.
He goes wild with it. It's incredible. So much detail packed into every damn inch. So he's great. But we're here to talk about you today. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about your history with horror?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I have just been nutty about horror since my teenage years. And then I ended up being a film video student when I was going to get my BFA in Massachusetts. And I went to Mass Art, and my teachers started introducing us to all different kinds of really cool, more artsy type films, you know, Jean Cocteau, Maya Darren. And so just that's how I sort of springboard into weird cult movie type stuff. And it's just one of those things when you get the bug and it just builds and builds over the course of your life. And I was also, in terms of books, like Stephen King. I remember reading Stephen King's The Shining when I was like 14 and just scaring the ever-living crap out of myself. So I just, you know, Edward Gorey was one of my favorite artists when I was a child. I've just always sort of had a draw to the dark side, the macabre.
Hell yeah. I'm curious if you have a favorite subgenre. You know, in your work, I see a lot of vampire imagery, nunsploitation, obviously. Is there one subgenre where you're like, this is a hit every single time?
Yeah, you know, I really love anything that gets really bizarrely like phantasmic, where, you know, it can be monster, it can be ghost, but when it goes like full bore crazy, and I mean, possession is the perfect example of something like that. But, you know, like, you know, Stuart Gordon's From Beyond, you know, like I'm a sucker for a haunted house. You know, I have seen some haunted house movies that I, you know, I was not super into, but if there's a, you know, a spooky house, I'm probably going to be pretty invested in it. Yeah.
Hell yeah. Well, like you said, we're talking today about Possession, which fits right into that. It's the autobiographical surreal triumph entrenched in the subjective perspective of yet another wonderful Sam Neill horror performance, pitched to Paramount as the movie where a woman fucks an octopus. In the making of documentary, director Andre Zulofsky said, "I dare you to give a coherent explanation, like I dare myself to give a coherent explanation of evil." We're going to try, Andre.
Unbelievable. That is such a great quote.
Yeah. So when I was trying to parse this movie, which it was not my first watch, but it's certainly one that merits watch and watch again. And so while I was trying to sort of really sit with what it was saying, I was reading some commentary from Luz Irigaray. She's a French philosopher, both student and critic of Jacques Lacan. And she rose to prominence because she correctly assessed that the philosophical field was denying women a female subject position, that they were either forcing them to assimilate to male subjectivity or be simply associated with nature matter. And to put it plainly, she felt that women were being excluded from defining culture. And her suggestion on how to change that contemporary culture included strategic essentialism, which is controversial in and of itself. But to sum that up, basically says it can be helpful for pressed upon social groups to build an identity so that they can choose what it is and self-represent, sort of working with the constructivism of our natural society. And some people are like, well, every single person is unique, so it's not helpful to define women as this and men as this. But there is a certain benefit to distinguishing yourself from the oppressing group, especially if you're trying to build an identity. The reason that I bring this up is because Possession is very grounded in a male perspective.
Yes.
And has that essentialist view where they are clearly distinct. And despite Andre's aggrieved aggression towards women and viewing their unbound sexuality as becoming a monster in his eyes, it can still affirm the differences of female sexuality, I think. Especially if you mentally flip perspective, it's very easy, I think, to sympathize with Anna's disgust at the, like, rigid paradigms that are being upheld by every single man in this movie.
Yes.
Even though it is so grounded in the male perspective, if you do the mental exercise of flipping that, it's very easy to take a positive female message away from it as well, I think.
Yeah, I see all that. For me, the thing that rings the most powerful and the most intense is the disintegration of a relationship. Mm-hmm. And have you seen Bad Lieutenant starring Harvey Keitel?
I have.
So I'm a very performance, you know, when I fall in love with an actor that portrays a character in a way that just, it's undeniable. That's why I think Isabella Adjani and Sam Neill give two of the best performances in any movie ever made in this film. Mm-hmm. It's like the whole film is like the most intense parts of like Harvey Keitel's performance. And it is just bananas, you know, one thing after another, you're just getting pummeled. The pacing in this film is unbelievable. And I definitely think the, you know, gender archetypes are a huge part of it. And much like Lars von Trier, you know, you feel that like nasty hatred from the male perspective for not only women in general, but the concept of, you know, possessing a woman, possessing her body.
Right.
And then that if she dared to, you know, take a lover and betray you, you know, turning that into a monstrous phantasmagorical being is so interesting. But I like what you said, because I think Anna's character is just, she's like a she demon from hell. I mean, you can't.
Hell yeah.
Her presence is just, it just makes your blood run cold. It's out of control.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is a transnational endeavor. Zulawski,
yes,
conceived Possession in Poland, then co-wrote it with Frederick Tootin in New York. Then they shot in West Berlin, the closest location to the Eastern Bloc, with a French producer and a little over $2 million. And in fact, part of the conception was exactly what caused this global trek. Poland was undergoing what is called the moral anxiety film wave, which isn't really compatible with Andre's style. It's a lot more cinema verite versus his surrealism. He described them as movies about morals without morality, which I thought was also very interesting.
Interesting.
So 2 months before the end of shooting The Silver Globe, which was Andre's movie that he was working on, that actually wasn't released for like 18 years afterward, the culture minister halted production because he suspected that it was criticizing the communist government, as Andre did in his previous film, The Devil, which was banned by this minister as well for blasphemous imagery. So while he waits to hear, Possession starts to coalesce, and they gave him a passport and basically said, get the hell out of here.
I mean, it makes sense to me. I still need to see The Silver Globe. Did he actually finish it, or did he pass away before it was actually complete?
Basically, they put out the 2.5-hour version that did get finished, and then there's, okay, like a narrator that chimes in and is like, here's what's missing and what didn't get finished in these parts here.
Okay, I have seen The Devil.
Yeah, I actually watched that this morning. I thought it was quite good as well, although I did think Possession was better.
A huge step up.
Yeah, yeah. And the other piece of the personal life implosion does relate to his divorce from the star of his first two,
yes,
movies. Women, like I said, women are as a source of fear and anxiety. This is in several of his movies.
Yes.
And exaggerated emotions are not unique to women, but victimhood is reserved for male characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has self-admitted that Mark is a stand-in for the emotional turmoil that he felt at this time.
Oh, and you can feel it. And that's why I made the connection to Harvey Keitel, because I've heard that, you know, when he did that performance in Bad Lieutenant, he was really like working some stuff out in his personal life, and it ended up in the performance. And that's how the way this movie is written, it feels so personal, even though it gets so weird and it's not really Lynchian, but you know, that sort of level of logic.
Mm-hmm.
you know, you feel how personal the story is to the director.
Definitely. It almost feels kind of like a Scream therapy, where he's like comparing this domestic back and forth to a political thriller. It's also this like cathartic revenge fantasy. He's attempting to escape the confines of this moral concern realism through expressionist extremism. And I think that he absolutely knocks it out of the park.
Absolutely. And I mean, not only are those two performances, I mean, they just melt my brain inside my skull. Everyone in the movie is incredible, but the cinematography, the lighting on their faces, I mean, some of those shots that he was able to get of her face and Sam Neill's face. I mean, I really can't think of another movie that it's quite like Possession.
Yeah, I love that the extremism does persist in the camera work. It's so active, and not in the like nauseating to me shaky cam, but like these powerful spins. It's this really incredible like pulse of movement that lines up with the immobility and trapped feeling that the characters have.
Absolutely.
It's great. And it really plays into what's happening on screen. Sexual pleasure, fear, horror, it literally becomes visible.
Absolutely. And I love how they keep doing those scenes in the kitchen. It's just so claustrophobic in there. I'm just like, I would never want to in this kitchen, you know, and then she's using that weird meat thing and there's meat everywhere. And I also love, I just find it hilarious that their son's name is Bob. I don't know why kids named Bob really crack me up.
There's, I think it's House by the Cemetery. Yeah. One of those Fulci movies.
That little blonde kid, he's in a lot of horror movies.
Hey, he made a run of it. I do also want to talk about the poster, which is interesting. It does also, I think, demonstrate that fear of women.
Yes.
It has a woman with her head thrown back in pleasure at the touch of the writhing mass of tentacles behind her. Not only a direct allusion to something that happens in the movie, but it does also create this Medusa-like image.
Yes.
A famous representation of castration, while also emblematic of male discourse about being female.
Interesting. Interesting.
So a lot going on there. And hey, the title, like you said, is a double meaning because viewing women as a possession and also demonic possession. So there you go.
Absolutely. I love the settings as well. You know, you can't really get more grimy than the subway scene where she miscarries or that just like straight out of the ninth ring of hell, that apartment where the octopus thing is sort of growing, like, it's just so grotesque, and the colors, you know, the greens in there, it's so drab. It's beautiful. Oh, yeah. And I also really struck in this viewing by, you know, in my memory, I had remembered all of the strange movements and gyrations of Anna's character and Mark, but it's like every single person in this movie, Heinrich, you know, everybody, like, they all are just, it's almost like they're under psychic attack, you know? It's like they just will start convulsing or putting their hands in these bizarre positions, and it's just relentless. It's so interesting.
Even in the scene where they're sitting in the private detective's office and Mark is spinning much more severely, but it is reflected in the private eye as well, who does mirror him a little bit.
Yeah. So
it's really interesting for sure. Like you said, Sam Neill plays Mark. Absolutely incredible. Sam Waterston was interested in the role, which I think also might have been interesting, although not nearly as the savoir-faire that Sam Neill brings to this. I think it's just so fascinating the way he flips the switch. Mm-hmm. You know, there are moments where he is charming.
Absolutely.
And it's just, I think Sam Neill does that so perfectly. It's why he's so great in these horror movies, for him to just be empathetic as an everyman and then also be able to go to the edge like that.
Absolutely. And for me, I really felt like their chemistry was really believable. And, you know, that's really important, and especially with the plot of this movie. Like, if you can't really buy them being together, the whole thing would just fall apart.
Yeah, not only them being together, but then also the fact that as she leaves, she is still feeling the pull. Like, she's still, there is a piece of her that wants to be with Mark and go back to that. But
by the end of watching it this time, I was like, man, they really probably should have just broken up a while ago. You know?
Yeah, by the time it gets to this point, maybe you should have seen a few red flags or something.
When you're exploding apartments and, you know, drowning guys in vomit toilets, you know,
it's gone a little far. Isabelle Adjani plays Anna. She was initially trepidatious about this, but did finally accept and does play the role incredibly. She is the movie's embodiment of the monstrous feminine. To sum that up, the monstrous feminine differentiates itself from the idea that even women who are villains are simply demonstrating masculine traits and standing in for a male role.
Interesting.
It's tied specifically to motherhood in this movie, which then leads us to abjection theory, which is very, I think, crucial to this movie and seeing where it's coming from, because it basically ties ego development to body boundaries. And the abject does cover all bodily functions, but tends to skew contextually feminist, since in patriarchal social orders, the bodily functions of women, like menstruation, pregnancy, are more commonly deemed inappropriate for conversation and discussion.
Yes.
And this creates a feeling of shame in children who recognize themselves as cast off from the body of a woman, just like poop or menstrual blood. And it makes it so they have difficulty processing that shame because you're not allowed to talk about these things.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you can't get any more. I mean, the scene in the subway, this time it really made me kind of emotional just because of, you know, experiences I've had in my life, you know, being a woman and having to get medical care for any sort of reproductive issues is not pleasant. And, you know, sure. I was met with quite a bit of misogyny and it's, you know, going to one of the best hospitals in the country and still getting poor quality of care, especially the way people talk to you, is pretty shocking to be happening at this stage in society. But
yeah,
that is the sad reality. Obviously, with everything going on with our Supreme Court this past year, just unbelievably horrific.
Absolutely. I mean, you would hope that we had progressed since 1981, and it really doesn't feel like the fact that it feels so topical and timely is not a good thing for us.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I felt so bad for Bob, especially there's one scene where, you know, he's in the apartment and they're having that insane physical screaming, you know, hitting. And it's like, oh, man, that poor kid. Jesus.
Yeah, he literally represses it into sleep screams, and he has a rough go of it. And abjection and the boundary crossing thresholds are also a big part of socialization, wherein we have to sort of repress certain aspects of ourselves according to social sanctions. What does our society say is acceptable? Talking about women's bodies and stuff. And that can also lead to xenophobia, where borders are seen as a bodily area of exclusion as well. The country represents the body, and our borders are that threshold.
Interesting.
It is something that is at play at the Berlin Wall, obviously.
Yes. Yeah.
Itself an icon of rising nuclear tensions and the writer's disdain for what were, in Andre's view, the evils of communism, also communicated in the lighting distinctions as well. So really fascinatingly put on screen in every way, the cinematography, the lighting, the placement of the setting, like everything is working together to coalesce into such a fascinating work of art.
Absolutely. And that's what I really love. One of the things I love the most about this film is, you know, I absolutely love all different kinds of horror. I love B movies. I love schlock. This feels like something completely different. It's like high art meets just this very transgressive, you know, phantasmic horror. And it's just phenomenal.
Art house meets grindhouse.
Yep.
There we go.
I thought the soundtrack was really interesting. There's so many long stretches where there's absolutely no sound. And then I like that you said grindhouse, because when the you know, in the intro, and then when the music does kick in, it's got that kind of like, you know, really upbeat, kind of fun.
Yeah. it has like kind of a weird ironic feeling to it.
Yeah.
And one thing I really liked that he said in the commentary was that he had asked the composer to be kind of subtle, because in his mind, cinema is visual first and then sound. That it's a puff of light with meaning is what, to him, film is.
Oh, so I like that. That. Interesting.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
So in the movie, this trauma of abjection is seen in every aspect of it, pretty much. Not only the social abjection of fighting parents that Bob does repress, not only in Berlin's scar, not only in Anna's painful miscarriage of faith, but as integrally and early as the fragile Mark being forced onto his own by Anna's attempts at freedom and his feeling victimized by the lack of heteronormativity in his relationship.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are feelings associated with having the threshold be crossed and not being able to talk about it in a way that I think is really tied to the way that people and men specifically are not allowed to handle their emotions, right?
Absolutely. And that would really explain why there's so much of the visual cues of, you know, just these very extreme bodily movements that when you're hanging out with your friends, nobody moves around like they move around in Possession, you know. It's just, and that makes a lot of sense because there's so much just pain energy under the surface and not understanding how to, you know, have it come out of your mouth and have proper communication. I mean, they were poorly communicating right from the beginning. I mean, it just was screaming matches, like, right off the bat.
Yeah, absolutely. So they filmed in a few houses in the Turkish district close to the wall, with the crew themselves living in a house just 16 feet from the start of the barbed wire.
Wow.
Yeah, so very much in the heart of it. One challenge during shooting that they discussed on the making of documentary that I thought was really interesting was that the emphasis on surrealism and distortion meant using a lot of wide-angle lenses. And the problem is that requires a lot of coherence and bringing all of the important elements together at once. Instead of a, here's a close-up on a hand, here's a close-up on a cigarette, you can tell the audience what to pay attention to with those close-ups. With the wide shot, you have to trust the audience to tell what's important on their own, almost.
Interesting. I like that. Those wide shots are just delicious. The cinematography in this movie is... It's unreal. Each scene is like a new painting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That scene where she has the sunglasses on after he's hit her, and she just has the blood pouring out of her face. I love how you can see she's so kind of small, and then you can see the entirety of the streets with a wide angle, and it's stunning.
It really is. I also really liked, they were talking about how they're like chasing after her with the camera, and there is some like bounce, obviously, because you're running around with a camera. And he talks about how like, oh, it added to the like frantic feeling, but also it was just because like the Steadicam hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah. So,
like, you're going to get shaking in your camera.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, another visual cue that I can't think of another movie where actors do this to the extreme that is done in this movie is the eyes. Mm-hmm. Just the looks in both of their eyes. And it's again and again and again. And they literally look like they're possessed by demons.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And the intensity of the filming experience did take a toll on both leads. Adjani said she didn't want to see the dailies, and so she was surprised when it finally premiered. She said she was astounded at the way she was shown. It was psychological pornography, that the camera had no right to go that deeply into the human soul, which, very French of her,
I think. Wow. Did she have to go to a hospital after, or is that a rumor?
Right, so Zulawski was talking about this. He said that she did attempt suicide. And in a very darkly comic quip, he basically said that it was a very French diva thing to do, and that based on the tiny, tiny razor she used, not a real attempt. And so he basically convinced her to come back onto set and finish the movie. And he said, just watch. You're going to get a ton of awards and everyone's going to like lambast me. And basically that was what happened. But, you know, I think that it's interesting because he talked a lot about it's acting, and he doesn't feel bad about asking people to do these intense performances because they're actors and this is what they signed up to do. but that when you ask people to do things for real, whether that's have sex, hurt someone, that is where it becomes murky. And he really pushed back hard on that. And he was saying in the subway scene in particular, he said, "This is easier than lying next to Michael Douglas and pretending to have an orgasm."
Oh my God.
So, wow. Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting guy. I don't agree with everything that he said, but he certainly had a way of saying it.
I mean, that's pretty morally questionable. I mean, I am a huge fan of the film, so I am very glad the film exists, but I do not, it's not, does not bring me joy to know that it had such a horrific impact on her psychologically. And it reminds me of, this is not a unique thing. Like Hodorowski, for example, he specifically tried to put actors through horrific experiences to get the performance that he wants.
Right.
And that's something that you kind of have to, as a viewer, be like, am I okay with this?
Yeah. Where's my own personal threshold?
Yeah, exactly.
In 2016, she said, "Zulawski is a director who draws you into his dark world and drowns you in his darkness. His films are special, but always focus on women, making women look like a lily. Filmmaking was exciting, but it was very grueling to shoot. When the filming was over, I questioned how and why I did this." And yeah, I mean, I think that, like you said, it comes out so impactful because of that, but you do have to find your own comfortability with it. Is this an acceptable thing to you? I think that because she did make it through it and she ultimately felt okay with it and it was all just acting, for me it is acceptable, although I would understand why other people felt otherwise.
Yeah, and I really think the art of acting is it's a very unique art form, and there are people that do method acting. And, if you're portraying, like a horrific serial murderer, there's no way you don't make some sort of energetic payment for that, it takes some sort of toll. And that's, of course, up to each individual actor to know their own threshold. But, I mean, it's certainly something to be considered.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It did take possession a while to find any sizable audience, thanks to its combined banning in England as a video nasty, delayed release in Germany to the 20th anniversary of the wall coming down, and only getting released uncensored in the US through Anchor Bay in the year 2000. So a ton of factors at play into determining why it didn't really have an audience. The edited version that came out in America was down to 81 minutes.
Oh.
That's a third of the total length cut.
Yeah. Wow. It's so awful when that happens. One of my favorite films, pretty much my favorite movie, is Ken Russell's The Devils, and, infamously banned. I got so freaking lucky because we have the music box here, and they screened the uncut version on film on my birthday. And that was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. But, movie, beautiful masterwork of art, has been banned and censored and cut. And if you don't get that that scene that they especially are always cutting out, is like, it just adds so much to the movie. It's a shame.
It really is. Yeah, it is upsetting when, like, it's such a finely balanced thing too. Like, it's so easy for someone to just be like, "This makes me feel weird, cut this out." And like, for so many people, like, put so much into crafting it the exact way that it was. It just really is, like, it is upsetting when like these movies get slashed to bits like that.
Absolutely. It's like if I put my paintings up in the gallery and the gallerist is like, "I love these paintings, but I'm just going to put one brush stroke here." That's basically what they're doing. And that's really got to be an awful feeling.
Absolutely. Let's crop. We just want to show this portion of the painting.
Exactly.
Yeah. It did get I was talking to you off air where you had mentioned that you watched it in the morning, and the press screening at Cannes for the very first showing of this was at 8:30 in the morning.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Very funny to me, imagining getting surprised by this that early, not knowing what you're getting into. No neutral reactions, which was understandable.
Yeah. It had to be like Cronenberg's Crash, just like everybody just like, either sitting there gripped beyond imagination or just walking out, I would imagine.
Yeah, people were scandalized.
I mean, it is, as much as it is, you know, so bizarre and all these characters are so strange, it's a pretty gripping portrayal of just the death of a relationship. In some ways, it is actually very realistic, especially their fights, you know, the domestic violence, the sex scenes. It's very intense.
Yeah, it's almost funny, like, how still autobiographical it feels in this movie where, like, a woman gives birth to a monster that, like, it just exists in this room as like a multi-tentacled guy. Like it's just so, but like, yeah, it is grounded and bizarre at the same time in such a fascinating way, a unique way, I would say.
Absolutely.
And the uncut version has become more and more obtainable. So too has the cult following, leading to today where we're declaring it the best horror movie ever made.
Yes.
So let's get into the actual movie. From the minute this thing starts, there's a really interesting and thematic split on screen with the Berlin Wall separating this long garden slash park from the heavily residentialized area. There is also graffiti on it of what would become a slogan of the era, "The Wall Must Go," but before it had caught on, which I thought was interesting and is so clearly tied to the visual coding of the movie, this idea of breaking down the wall and trying to get back, bring things back together into one cohesive thing. Obviously, the Berlin Wall still had a way to go, but it was sort of the beginning of the decline at this time.
Absolutely.
Sam Neill's character, Mark, gets out of a taxi. He's arriving home from a work trip as a spy to find his extremely distressed wife, Anna, asking for a divorce. This is the beginning of the end for them. Mark is sort of surprised by this. And he claims it's natural for feelings to change, but without her, he won't feel anything at all. And she asks him, "What do you feel now?" He doesn't have an answer, and it feels like, or it seems like, nothing at all anyway.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like they are both, especially, you know, that archetypal view of a man that does not know how to express his emotions. I mean, it's, the character is riddled with it.
You can see that even in the way that he's debriefed by this panel the next morning, where it's super like they're pressuring him. They're trying to get him to sign back up, but he is just cool as a cucumber. He has no emotion during that scene either. And of course, the camera is spinning around them, makes it feel overwhelming, but he does insist he needs to quit at least for a while because of family issues. And he does leave with a huge wad of cash.
And they never really say exactly what he does, right?
Right. He is implied to be a spy, possibly having crossed over to East Germany or whatever.
Okay.
Possibly one of the other surrounding countries. But yeah, it's just like this nebulous nothing of like, you could kind of make it whatever. It doesn't super apply until you're like, oh, well, I guess this explains like why he knows how to blow up an apartment and stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, we have to just assume he's really good at whatever he does because they're so aggressively like, we do not want to replace you. We want you.
Right. Oh, almost like he does with her.
Mm-hmm.
Blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And he returns to an empty home, although people from the other side of the wall are checking him out with some binoculars. And after waiting all day, he finally gets a call from Anna, who says she's downtown and needs some time to think about her with "for a change" clearly implied. And Mark starts to tear through the house looking for some kind of external clues about what might have caused this, obviously refusing to look inward.
Yes. I think his character is incapable of taking responsibility for his part in why this relationship started to fall apart.
That's right. And tucked away, he does discover a postcard from the Taj Mahal saying, "I've just seen half of God's face here, the other half is you," signed by some Heinrich. Heinrich? Who the hell is Heinrich?
Heinrich is so great. I mean, that character was cast perfectly. I really loved his character. He added some fun to a very, very dark film.
It's so funny where, like, the moderator of the commentary, he did a really great job, I thought, especially because he was like, "Talk about this motif," which was helpful. But when Heinrich came on screen, he was like, talk about Heinrich. And Zelowski was just like, I hate him.
Well, of course, he's the other man.
Exactly. He liked the actor, but the representation of who he was truly was upsetting to him. And so he hates the character, which I thought was really funny.
Later in the film, you know, Sam Neill says something like, I think he's talking to Heinrich's mom, you know, and he's like, I understand Heinrich's better than me. I'll never be as good as Heinrich. And I feel like that's the director's own, you know, complex.
Making itself known for sure. Call from Anna confirms his fears. It has been going on for a while. Yes, she does sleep with him. Yes, he's better at sex, and I'm here with him now. And so they meet up at a cafe to discuss the future. I love the way that this is arranged. The mirror showing just emptiness as they sit around the corner from each other. Yes. They can't even look each other in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, incredible.
Absolutely. And then just tearing the restaurant apart, and then half the staff has to take him down. Yes.
Three chefs have to come tackle this guy.
And they have the little chef hats.
Yeah. Part of the reason that it gets so heated is because although Mark agrees to child support for their son, Bob, he says he doesn't even want to see him at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's going to be fucked up enough as it is. I don't want to fuck him up even more by playing Sunday Daddy. Now, this is difficult because they agree that he wasn't really there before. So mm-hmm. is this really going to be a big difference? But they clearly disagree on that being the case going forward.
Mm-hmm.
She tells him, fine, if you want to be this way, I'll be the bad guy. And if I'd met this guy before you, trust me, there'd be no Bob, which sets him off. This is the questioning not only his manhood, but his suitability as a father. It was a step too far for Mark, and he does mm-hmm. explode in anger, destroying this restaurant.
Mm. I thought it was very interesting, you know, a little off topic, but, you know, connected. There's multiple scenes where there's one where he has Bob and Bob doesn't have his shirt on and like you can't really see Bob's face. And Sam Neill is just sort of holding his chest and just staring at him. And they do the same shot with him and Anna. And
that's right.
It's just so bizarre. It's very uncomfortable both times.
Right. Yeah. So Andre basically said that what's going on there is that it's such an intimate thing to be skin to skin with someone like that. And for him, that was like the demonstration of love. So for when it happens with him and Anna, that they're saying like, oh, there is still that love, but that he is like a child. In that moment, like the way that he is having this paternal affection towards Bob, she is looking at him almost like a child as well because of his incapability of expressing his emotions correctly, of meeting her at her level. But she does still have that affection for him.
Wow.
And there's a great cut to him all shriveled and hunched over, dialing a phone slowly.
Oh, yeah.
It's days later and he is looking grim.
Oh yeah, when he was in the hotel for he's doesn't 3 even
weeks.
Know. Yeah, he doesn't even know how long he's been there, and then they say it's 3 weeks.
Oh man, what a
unbelievable.
Blackout. Good Lord.
His face, the makeup, the way they did it, I mean, I was convinced. I mean, it was
the sweating that he's doing, it really looked like when you're like sweating out alcohol the next day during the hangover.
Yeah.
Like, he was rough.
He looked gray, you know?
That makes it all the more concerning when he returns to the apartment he shared with Anna and finds Bob there alone and filthy, fending for himself.
I know. Poor Bob.
Poor Bob. Yeah. He says, Mommy said she would be right back, but she never came.
Oh, poor Bob. I thought it'd be fascinating for somebody to make a new script picking up the thread of Bob as an adult.
Interesting. Yeah, well, if he survived whatever goes on in the end.
that's true.
There was a very funny moment in the commentary where Andre was like, kids are great actors for one take.
Yeah, I think they do it right. You know, he's not really in the film a ton. If they had put Bob in there more, it might have gotten a little grating.
Yeah, beyond that, he also did talk about like, I respect children because they are the closest to good. I don't respect women. I don't respect men, but I understand them. I respect children.
Wow.
Yeah, so I thought that that was an interesting possible reason for him not to want Bob in it as much, and that's why he tries to avoid children in his movies in general.
Mm. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. He waits for Anna in the living room, absolutely going to town on that rocking chair. No one has rocked like this before or since.
I love that scene. Oh my God. Unbelievable. I feel like I've seen movies, I can't name one, but where they try and do something like that, but it's never anywhere near it.
Can't be done. He is 180 degrees parallel to the ground at one point. I don't know how he's not falling backwards.
So good.
She rushes in. She says it's not usually like this, but he doesn't care. He continues to rock and sweat in his filthy jacket and say, "I'm taking over here now." Not what you want. This filthy, passed out for 3 months or 3 weeks, drunk guy being like, "All right, I'm in charge now because you missed, because you were a little late or something." Like, Mark, come on, man.
Yeah, Mark's not really a good dude. You know, it's complex, but you know, not really a good dude.
No. He demands that she call Heinrich and end things, not face to face. There's a grim irony to this as well, because he's saying she has to restore order because he's not her family, but he also doesn't trust her to do it face to face. So the family unit is already busted. If he's not willing or able to trust her, then what is he trying to save here? Also, the way it's composed, Mark seems to like surround her on all sides. There's already the super tight framing that you talked about. If you want to stay, make that call, he says.
Yeah, he really, as much as they both really go off on mentally deranged tangents, he specifically, I feel like, is just all over her in this suffocating way that it just, it makes, as a woman, you know, watching it, it makes me very uncomfortable because, you know, I've dated some interesting people in my life, but you know, wow. That scene where they're in the kitchen and he just won't, he's just in her space to such a degree. She has no room to breathe.
Yeah. He's handsy, just literally like telling her to stop crying. It's just really awful. And they did talk about trying to shoot this scene in the confined room. They literally had their asses hanging out the window with like the camera and the lighting.
Oh, wow.
Above them. So truly whatever worked for them.
I mean, having it in that kitchen added to the level of suffocation like 1,000 times.
Yes, absolutely. She finally does stop crying and he undresses her and tucks her into bed until he awakes with a start himself alone in bed. This is a really great surreal moment. It breaks the 180 degree rule, completely flips the room, which throws you off and puts you in the same startled shoes as Mark, obviously very intentionally.
Absolutely.
And he gets a call from Heinrich, who says Anna is with him and is going to stay there, and Mark can't track her down to his frustration, but Bob is keeping him slightly tethered. There are moments of lucidity when he is being a dad and taking him to school or whatever, where like you're like, okay, he at least has these moments of normalcy, of competency.
Absolutely.
But he takes Bob to school and the teacher looks exactly like Anna, but with bangs and green eyes. He even thinks it's a wig, but she laughs it off. Andre did talk about the doppelganger motif a bit. He said, "We're all divided into someone who wants to be good and someone who wants to be bad or is bad, that we're not totally one or the other, but we fight." And obviously that really plays, that idea of fighting for the other one to be unified, I think, is a thematic resonance here.
It's so interesting, too, because she has the same color eyes as the duplicate of Mark.
Right.
So I always wondered if she was a spawned thing too, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, could be. Mark does find Heinrich's place. He actually kind of looks like an older version of Mark, in my opinion. So there is a little bit of doppelganger action going on there too. Yeah. Heinrich welcomes him in, almost embracing him, while saying Anna hurt him too, but he accepts her because nobody has the right to impose his will on anybody. According to Andre, he's meant to be a representation of the Polish counterculture, a mixture of leftism and impending New Ageism, and even terrorism, according to Andre.
Okay, I definitely could tell that that character was interested in some sort of spiritual enlightenment. And I really like the addition of his mom being part of the scene.
Yeah. Yeah, she's fun.
Also, just seems like a guy like that would live with his mom.
Mark attacks him and promptly gets his ass kicked, which is very funny, in my opinion.
It's so funny.
Does this, like, karate kick on him. Oh, man. It's good stuff.
He really trounces him.
Yeah. But Heinrich denies the phone call, saying he had been in Hamburg, and Anna wasn't at Margie's, like her note said. So the question then becomes, where was she?
Mm-hmm.
Anna is back at the apartment, and her face falls when Mark asking exactly this, threatening to check up on her answer. And she says, oh, I was with new friends. I was alone. God damn it. Stop nagging me, Mark. Again, this suffocation of where were you? I'm going to check up. I'm like, you need to be at my beck and call. I need to know where you are at every second. Like, oh, my God. No wonder she's been looking for a way out.
Absolutely. The whole film, he is just on her to a degree that is just so suffocating.
Yeah. And she says the only reason she's still here is for Bob. And Mark says, oh, if you really loved him, you'd never have broken us up, which, in my opinion, is frankly not true.
Mm-hmm.
Better to have a healthy demonstration of love, although that didn't work out as intended, I guess.
Like I said earlier, really, they should have just broken up a while ago. Like, oh, yeah. My dear God. I mean, I don't have kids, but I feel like if you love your children, if your relationship has gotten that out of control, that toxic, the most kind thing you can do is, you know, part ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And she is freaking out. Oh, you're right always, Mark. Don't you understand? You disgust me. I can't stand you touching me. You make me. And she screams. Mm-hmm. And Mark is having a tough time with this. He says, you want me to believe you're, she says, a whore. Yes, a monster, a whore. I fuck around with everybody. And he threatens to force her to stay, where she says, I would simply open the window and jump. She is so desperate to escape him. And the fight does become physical, with Mark beating the crap out of her after she slaps him for saying, fuck your needs. Again, she is in the right here. Fuck your needs is like top three worst things you could say to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's just truly a nightmare situation for her. Like, when you think of, like I said, when you flip mental perspective and you put yourself like, oh, what would this movie be like if I were in Anna's shoes instead of Mark's shoes? It's just so quickly and easily fathomable why she is fighting to get out of this.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, when we get in later in the film, you know, there's a lot of murders. But before that point, I mean, you know, obviously having an affair like that is not good. But, you know, she's kind of pushed. He's really suffocated, not given her, not fulfilled any of her needs, suffocated her. I mean, it's like this is the type of behavior people do when they're not getting their needs met, you know.
Right. And he's unconcerned about that. Fuck your needs, he says.
Exactly. And it's like, it's not, that doesn't make her, you know, like a satanic, demonic monster. It's, she's a human being that has needs and is not, they're not being met.
Yeah. She does get away, though. She's bleeding in the street as Mark threatens to follow her, only stopping when she attempts to get run down by a passing truck.
Mm-hmm.
And on my third watch of it, I paused it and considered what an insane stunt that looks like. Like, it looks so dangerous.
Yeah.
She lunges into the road and it really almost hits her.
There's a lot of moments in that movie that seem like the filming probably was actually legitimately dangerous.
Yeah. He does immediately turn back on dad mode. He plays soccer with the kids in the apartment complex. Then he is approached by Aunt Margie, Angel of the Extinct Heart, limping to the rescue. she's going to look after Bob. And then she starts to undress Mark while they each discuss how much they loathe each other. I'm curious if you think that there is an affair happening there as well.
I was so confused by that on this watch. I feel like the last time I saw it, I don't know if that just completely went over my head. But I remember those characters just loathing each other. And, you know, sometimes people that loathe each other have some sexual chemistry. But right. Yeah, I like that they leave it open for you to just be like, okay, so is he fucking her? And that's right. Okay? Because, I mean, I think it really just builds the case that, you know, he really doesn't have a ground to stand on here, you know?
Right, right.
No matter what
tisk,
it was.
Tisk, tisk for you, but not for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, I think, ties back. One of the very earliest moments is he asks her when she first asked for a divorce. He says, like, oh, were you unfaithful? And she says no, which is a lie, I guess. But also his answer is not really when she asks him the same thing, which makes me wonder, like, is there, like, did he and Margie almost hook up one time? Mm-hmm. Like, it really does do a great job of letting you fill in the cracks of the world almost.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And Margie's character is very interesting. I feel like every time I see this movie, I think about that character and I'm like, what the hell is going on with that character? Yeah. I just don't understand.
Yeah, Andre was giving her major props. He was saying that these kinds of roles are not easy because nothing is for them.
Mm-hmm.
All of their lines and stuff are to move the other plot forward.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, it's not a loved role a lot of times. People aren't like, oh yeah, I loved Margie in that movie. But it is a really solid performance. And she does do a necessary component of the movie.
Absolutely. She really nailed it.
Yeah. Mark does hire private detective Zimmerman to follow his wife. Again, they're spinning in the chairs, like I mentioned. One thing I thought was interesting in the commentary was Andre talking about how pathetic and paradoxical this is for Mark, because he's been reduced from this spy the government was begging to stay on to this classic cuckolded husband asking a private detective for help. He has been reduced to this cliche.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like maybe some personal experience. Not kidding.
He comes home that night, seems maybe drunk, and he tucks his son into bed, then Margie, until he changes his mind, wakes Margie up, and they embrace. Again, it's questionable what actually happens, but the next morning, Anna is back. And this is where we get this really, really wild scene. He tries to confront her in the kitchen, badgering her with questions, but she's trying to prepare this meat. And he's constantly in the way, and she gets more and more frustrated despite her initial politeness. She's like pretty polite at the beginning.
Yeah.
But finally, she can't take the questioning and demands for help anymore, and she tries to cut her throat with the electric carving knife.
Mm-hmm.
And it does cut her, but just a flesh wound. And he says, there's Bob, remember, holding her hostage, basically, as he cleans her up.
Mm-hmm.
But especially because then he says, you're my whole family. Like, to him, Bob is just a tool. He is just a way to keep her bound to him, his possession, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, if you ever do work on yourself, you know, there you can get to this point where you kind of realize you have to give yourself love. If you're expecting this person outside of you to be the 100% source of love, this is not a fair thing to do to this other person. Like, you can't rely on them for that. It's just, they can't provide that. So what he even wants from her is an impossibility.
Absolutely. He heads into the kitchen and starts to cut himself with the carving knife as well.
Mm-hmm.
There was kind of an unsettling moment in the commentary where Andre starts talking about how we're mostly blood held in by this delicate skin. So why shy away from showing it? I was like, oh, I don't want to think about how we're mostly blood.
Got a very I like some of the poetic statements he makes about this film. They're very
It is also interesting, I think, because of the autoerotic giving up of dominance here. He creates these vulvic slashes on his arm, and she says, doesn't hurt, does it? Implying, along with her symbology of meat grinding, that castration can open someone up to new desire or pleasure paradigms, that you don't have to be so attached to a penis or the phallus or whatever to find joy and pleasure, and you can be yourself, you know, find other alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
Anna says that she has to go now and she can't wait for Bob. I thought it was so funny that there's just this huge pile of raw minced meat behind them that they no longer give a shit about.
It looks so gross. It's just like, it does not look like any way you prepare that, I would want to eat it. You know,
right.
I don't know what's going
it
on
is
there.
Nasty over there. Just a pile of raw beef on the on the counter there. Zimmerman's PI follows her to a train. She sits next to a ragged-looking gentleman who takes one of her bananas to go with his vodka. No words exchanged. I really love that scene.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't add a ton, but it does show you who she is. And so in that way, it does add a ton. That, she allows this to happen. She is normal when she's not having this insane relationship pressed upon her.
Exactly. And, you know, the way the movie is shot, you don't really get to see a lot of other people. And so there is this very, lonely emptiness to the city, that part of the city where they live.
Yes.
And so I think that's an important moment to just remember that there's other people in the world besides this freakazoid couple.
Yeah. When she gets off, he tracks her to a rundown little apartment, calls it in, then enters pretending to be a window inspector. I really love this shot of him knocking. It's not only a cool, tilted angle from above, but there's even, banisters in the extreme foreground. It does a really cool job of creating depth.
And those doors are so incredible.
Mm-hmm. She seems terrified to have him there, and we go through the apartment, seeing the appealing wallpaper, the dirt, and finally he heads for the bathroom. She tries to convince him not to go in. There's no windows in there. Oh, have some wine. But he insists. And the bathroom is covered in slime, and there's a creature in there. So Anna sneaks up and bottles the hell out of him, not just smashing his head, but slicing his throat several times.
Mm-hmm.
And the creature is gross, to be sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We'll only get grosser.
And I really love the way it's filmed, because one of my least favorite things is when they overshow a monster, and this movie nails it where it's like the lighting, you just get a glimpse, so your imagination fills in all the rest, and it makes it even more horrifying.
Yeah. In the making of documentary, the producer talked about how she and Andre went to see Alien, and immediately he was like, oh fuck, we need this guy. And then Geiger wound up being too busy, which can you imagine how even more fucked up this would be if Geiger had gotten his freaky little Swiss mitts on it?
Oh my God. That would have been incredible.
Yeah. But then he directed them to Carlo Rambaldi, frequent Dino De Laurentiis collaborator. He also worked on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And does do a very admirable job with it, especially considering the balance that they have to strike of showing versus not showing.
Mm-hmm.
She also the producer discussed how it scared the customs officers when Carlo arrived in Berlin with 5 coffins, and when they opened one up, they found a mass of tentacles popping out like damn snake in a can.
That's awesome. Oh my God. I would love to be a fly on that wall.
Yeah. Andre also, he discussed, I thought this was interesting. I always like in commentaries when they're a little more open about what went wrong. It doesn't seem like they're trying to cover up. And just be like, oh, it's a perfect movie. So Andre talked about being a little frustrated with Carlo because he said he was spoiled by the American system, where basically he showed up and was like, great, we have 3 weeks to make this monster, right? And Andre was like, we have to shoot tomorrow, man.
Oh, shit.
But it worked. They got it.
That, that's sort of like Toby Hooper, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That film was made in a couple of days or something. And sometimes when you have constraints like that, you can get performances out of these creators that are just unfreaking believable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It cuts to the clean white tile of the bathroom in the apartment with Mark giving a white bubble bath to Bob while wearing white clothes. Obviously this clear intention on purity and cleanliness and all that jazz. They're interrupted by Bob's teacher, Helen, who Mark foists off drying duties onto, which seems very strange.
Yeah.
But he has to go answer the door again because Heinrich is here.
Yeah, it's like, can't she hear their conversation over there? like, it's very fucking weird, you know?
For sure. It's very bizarre. And just be like, oh, teacher, come in and clean my child up is seems very strange to me, but what do I know? He's looking for Anna, Heinrich is, although Mark denies him gladly. And they circle each other kind of like dogs, I thought was very interesting physicality there. But Heinrich leaves with this exchange. Mark says, I used to be afraid of you, but I don't think I am anymore. And Heinrich says, there's nothing to fear except God, whatever that means to you. And he says, for me, God is a disease. And so Heinrich says, that's why through the disease, we can reach God. This is obviously applicable to what Anna has been doing, this idea of all of that abjection, all of these fluids and stuff that have come out of her being the thing that gives her love, being the faith that she is protecting. It is just interesting that it is in this patriarchal society looked at as disease, as something not to be talked about, but that it is you know, exactly what Mark is looking for, this family, this relationship.
Absolutely.
Helen has moved on from putting Bob to bed and reading him a bedtime story to doing the damn dishes. She truly is Mark's servile dream woman. Looks like Anna with none of that pesky independence. And she tells Matt that Bob won't tell her anything, but he sees and knows and cries and shouts during sleep, then pretends nothing happens when he wakes up. And Mark responds with what he views as Anna's flaws in motherhood, saying he's at war against women, that they have no foresight, stability, or trustworthiness, which does not impress Helen, as you might imagine. She says no two women are alike, that his stories of women being contamination are pathetic, and that it's sad for him, freedom seems to mean evil. And what about lack of freedom?
Hell, is that not evil? Take that, right. Mark, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, Mark. Fuck you, Mark.
I also thought the double was almost really humorous to me this time, because, like, I don't know, you just, when people break up, it's so common that they end up just dating someone that looks exactly like their ex. Right. It's kind of humorous sometimes, you know?
Definitely, definitely. Zimmerman approaches Mark about the missing detective, revealed to be his live-in boyfriend, though Matt seems not just undisturbed by this, but completely untroubled at this point. He simply wanted to find his wife out of blind ambition, and now there's nothing ambitious left in him, he tells Zimmerman.
Now that he's got a replacement.
Right. Zimmerman goes to check the apartment himself, finding the door open and Anna scrubbing. The camera spins around them as they both admit they're scared, although Zimmerman should probably be more scared, finding a bloody monstrosity on the bed, an unfinished moving husk exhausted from having sex with Anna all night.
I love that line. He's tired. He made love to me all night, or whatever she says. It's like the best line. I fucking love it. It's like, hell yeah, oh my Anna. God.
Get you some, girl.
The detectives were dating, right? The two detectives?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they lived together. Yeah. He said that he was his boyfriend, basically.
That's so cool. I didn't pick up that detail the last time I saw it. That's why it's so cool to rewatch a movie like this, because there's so much going on. It's really easy to miss stuff.
Yeah, especially in the secondary characters.
Mm-hmm.
He also finds the corpse of the previous investigator and in despair shoots at Anna. She seems to almost puke with rage, then beats him senseless with a milk bottle before finishing him with his own gun.
Ugh.
Powerful stuff. And of course, milk tied to motherhood as well, so it's fitting that she uses this as her weapon here. Mark gets a film reel left at his door from Heinrich, which depicts Anna teaching about a ballet class, which creates an interesting contrast, again, between her and Helen, both teachers, but at opposite ends of the spectrum, according to Andre. The humble teacher educating children on elementary knowledge versus the frustrated teacher who couldn't make a career out of their specialized competitive field, and even if subconsciously, takes it out on the children as she pushes one of them past her breaking point.
Oh, that scene is so uncomfortable. Oh my God.
Painful, painful to watch.
Mm-hmm.
I did also want to shout out the transition to this. We like go past the projection through the curtains, almost back in time to the actual flashback. It's just really, really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Anna is having a tough time herself. She's trying to get the words just right. This is still in the footage. And she says that she recognizes the self that did something bad, like a sister passing on the street. And the two sisters are Faith and Chance.
Yes.
And Faith can exclude Chance, but Chance can explain Faith. And my faith didn't allow me to wait for Chance, and Chance didn't give me enough faith. So it's very sort of this, again, circling, where it's like, it's hard to parse. It's a lot of going back and forth, but the idea of having lost faith in herself as a person, in the relationship, all of these things dragging her down, where she's left to just chance, to the chance of the unknown, and removing herself from that situation.
Yeah, and you know, I know it's the moments where she is committing these horrific acts of violence, she feels sort of backed into the corner like a wild animal. But if you, like when you were talking earlier about flipping the perspective from her perspective, she feels like she's lost all of her power to Mark. And this is like maybe a form, you know, expression of female rage, trying to take her own power back. Obviously, it comes out in a very violent and horrific way, but there is something sort of admirable about that to some degree, you know?
Sure.
Just like someone pushed too far, I'm going to take all my fucking power back, you know?
That's right. That's absolutely right. One other thing she says in this moment that I found particularly interesting is that the private life is a stage, and she's stuck playing many roles that are smaller than me, and yet I play them. This is really intriguing to me because we all play many roles. Mm-hmm. We're all different things to each person. Mm-hmm. And yet, none of these roles, son, father, wife, mother, they can't capture the intricacies of our interiority.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way, again, this idea of like strategic essentialism,
yep,
you cannot really be pinned down to that because we are all different. We are inside, we have untold intricacies.
And that's why I love meditating so much, because it's one of the only moments in your life that you can just be.
There you go.
And it's okay. You don't have to fulfill a role for this person, that person. You just simply are allowed to exist as your, you know, almost purest form of yourself.
Yeah. And one of my favorite movies is Solaris, the Russian movie. It's interesting that this movie in general almost becomes the reverse of Solaris, where in that, the theme is basically this guy freaking out because it's so impossible to really know somebody else that his wife could be replaced by a ghost, and he basically, it wouldn't matter, that it would be the same person as far as he's concerned. But in this, we're turned into ghosts ourselves because of being known so little. Because she is just wife to Mark, that she has become a shade of her former self, of who Anna really is. I thought it was just really fascinating and does provide a really interesting counterpoint to it.
Absolutely. That's awesome.
She continues sort of half making sense, discussing how madness can pierce reality, again, emphasizing the subjectivity of everyone's perspective and basically this whole last movie, before saying that she doesn't need Heinrich as some kind of completion, that what drives her on is the idea of agency, of being able to cause Mark pain, but that that causes her the pain of evil. That yes, it is great for her to have this female rage and take that power back, but she does still know, like she still wants to be good. She doesn't want to be hurting people. And so it is sort of a split where she needs to have this power, but the only way she's able to take it is still self-damaging.
Yeah, and that's a testament to how just horrific this relationship. I think that's what happens when people stay in a connection that is just, you know, I don't believe people are toxic, you know, that word gets thrown around a lot. I believe people's behaviors are toxic. And, you know, when you stay in a dynamic like that for too long, I mean, it really starts to impact people in just really awful ways.
Yeah. Mark is finally thinking a little more clearly. He's feeling more powerful and in charge as she deteriorates, freaking out at her hands. She's screaming about feeling nothing for no one. And this is when she tells him the story of the two sisters, Faith and Chance, mm-hmm. wrestling in the mud, hands around their throats, waiting to see which dies first. And yeah, I mean, you talked about these close-ups on eyes and stuff. She's staring down the barrel of the camera in this extreme close-up. It's so intense, and you really, the emotion and pain in her eyes are so palpable.
Mm-hmm. I really can't think of another movie where that level of emotion is just emanating out of the faces. Like, it gives me goosebumps.
They talked in the commentary about why he thinks that she keeps coming back. And it's because Mark is trying to understand. And so as ineffective as he is, that this effort is tapping into what she once loved about him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the reason Mark does this is because the human heart is obscure. He loves her, so it doesn't matter that she's a killer, that Mark is willing to go into hell to save her, mm-hmm. Much like Orpheus and Eurydice, or Christ himself trying to save humanity was the other example that he gave. I think that it creates this really great thematic crossover there, because this then cuts to her staring desperately at Jesus on the cross. And so this mm-hmm. idea of Mark viewing himself as a Christ figure, basically, and then Anna looking up at Christ in despair, saying, "You can't actually save me." It's a really interesting blend and crossover there.
And, you know, it also makes me think of the unhealthy attachments we can form. And even if we recognize something is just awful for us, if we truly love someone or something, letting go of that attachment, it's just not simple. And that's what's happening between these two people.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a great bizarre angle as she really soaks in Jesus up there. She's starting to squirm. Yeah. She's making these pained whimpers. It is another interesting connection to abjection as well, because the core of religion is abjection and purification, you know, and fundamental Christianity would certainly deny her the freedom as a woman that is the cause of so much Mark's victimization.
Mm-hmm.
That this ties right in, that the whole point of Christianity would be for her to go be a servile woman to him, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to provide hope. It's supposed to this idea of faith being the thing that she has lost. I mean, if it's telling you that you should stay in this situation that is killing you, no wonder.
Yeah.
It is a cool contrast to go from the heavenly heights of this church to the hellish underground of the subway station.
Oh. Whew.
Powerful, powerful stuff. Anna is laughing maniacally as she walks alone down the empty corridor, which then turns to screams and then howls as she throws herself and her bag at the wall and ground, where she erupts from every orifice. I'm talking tears, blood, pus. As far as I'm concerned, that's three of the main body fluids.
Oh my gosh. When she's towards the end, like on her knees, and the goo just starts pouring out, you know, between her legs and over her shoulders, out of her mouth.
Yeah.
Holy shit. I mean, that whole sequence, I just, performance of a lifetime. So few actors could pull that off the way she did. It's unbelievable.
It really is. He Andre said she delivers her own self to the camera, and mm-hmm. and it's stripped bare. I mean, it's so raw. God, it really is powerful stuff.
It made me emotional this time. I feel like the first time I saw the film, you know, you're just in so much, you know, it's almost like you're being gaslit. You're like just trying to understand what the hell is going on. But, you know, the second time I just, it made me feel sort of emotional just watching her have that experience before the camera. It's just so raw.
It really is. And she evacuates this evil she doesn't even know is there. Andre talks about how the evil, if it's a word or an idea or whatever, takes on its own life post-evacuation, transforming into something that kills. His example was communism. He was very anti-communist, basically, because he said that he saw some really bad stuff happen in Poland, and that it was something that had been forced and enforced by the police and the state, and that the people that he was around didn't believe in this. And so the idea, you know, it wasn't like Marx was killing people, but once he had evacuated the words that became this idea, took on its own life, that was the thing that killed people.
Yeah, because when I was watching it this time, I really thought that the incredibly toxic energy created by these two people, you know, Mark wants to blame it all on her, but it's really both of them energetically working together to create this evil unleashed on the world. Fascinating.
Right. And she says, what I miscarried there was Sister Faith, but the miscarriage doesn't kill it. The ejection is, it brings a life of its own. She has to take care of it to protect it. And that's what she's doing at the other apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And as she feared, the story upsets Mark, who says, suddenly I view you as vulgar.
Mm-hmm.
And he demands her ring and wristwatch, and she leaves. I mean,
the second you start talking about miscarriages, most people are going to leave, unfortunately, in this world that we live in.
It was, I mean, it's so painful to watch Anna open up. This is what Mark has wanted. He wants her to talk to him and tell him what's wrong with the relationship so that they can work together to fix it. And when she does open up and tell him what she's feeling, he says, give me the ring and the jewelry that I gave you because I'm fucking out of here. Truly pathetic.
He immediately rejects her.
Mark gives Heinrich the address of the apartment, then sprints over to collect Bob, who is the last student there. So he is also fucking up as a father now. Heinrich does a big spin on his motorbike as he arrives at the apartment.
I love that he rides that motorbike. I just love Heinrich. He's such a great character.
He really is funny. And
the Miami Vice, like, white jacket.
He thinks he's so smooth, and it makes it so funny. He gets inside. He offers Anna psychedelics as he insists that they have sex. And what I think is interesting about this is that it demonstrates that he is still interested in her fitting an alternate but still restrictive paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost more insulting because it's in the name of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Mark is saying, I want you to be captive to me. I want you as my possession. And Heinrich is saying, oh, if you want to be free, you have to do what I say. We have to have sex whenever I want. Like, he is still reinforcing this awful lack of power that she has.
Exactly. He's taking her power away. Or attempting to.
That's right. And she seems to give in, but takes him in to see the creature, now more fully formed, but still quite grotesque and bloody. And Heinrich freaks out. He stumbles away from it, almost blinded, feels like, which I love. They don't ever talk about this, but he like has a difficult time stumbling back. It's just really great stuff.
That's one of those moments where it's like, it almost feels like psychic attacks. Like the characters are getting these energetic attacks because there is at least 15 seconds where he literally can't see.
Yeah. And he regains his sight just in time to find the chopped up corpse of Zimmerman in the fridge, and then gets stabbed as hell by Anna because she tells him, you're no different from anyone else, despite your claims of superiority and enlightenment. So he flees.
And he's so perfect as one of those people that truly believes they've attained enlightenment, but they're so far off. It's just hilarious, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And the being is on the bed again now, and Anna undresses to join it. That this is her one source of love, and it had to come from herself.
Gotta love yourself, baby.
That's right.
No matter how weird and grotesque it is on the inside, you gotta love that shit, baby.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Hey, you got a squid monster going on? Whatever it takes. Back at the regular apartment, Mark is playing with Bob when he gets a call from Heinrich, who's bleeding in a pub. Margie walks in and immediately has Bob pressed onto her because Mark has got to go see a lady about a demon. Every time that a woman walks into this apartment, Mark, like, abandons his child, basically.
Poor Bob.
It really is. Really poor Bob. The being and Anna both aren't there. But Mark does see the contents of the fridge, and you better believe both he and the camera are spinning, baby.
You know what I noticed this time that was like just like a tiny detail is the bananas from the bag are like rotting like right by the fridge. I just like that detail.
Hell
like,
yeah.
Like, gotta continue that thread.
That's right. Somebody in the test audience was like, what happened to the bananas? Mark gets some air and decides the best move is to set up a gas explosion before going to meet Heinrich, who he accuses of being high and imagining it. Or maybe that was God you just met, he says. And in a way, it sort of is. Heinrich says, if you're not going to help me, my silence is going to cost. But hold on, because just thinking about this thing is making me puke again. Which I love that. I mean, you, so many people talk about like cosmic horror and being unable to like understand what you're seeing. For Heinrich to be like, just thinking about this thing, I have to go puke again. Like, that's, I love the way that they executed this.
And like how gross that little bar bathroom is. It's so perfect.
Yeah.
And I really like the angle. That there's a lot of angles above the stalls. Cool camera work in there.
Yeah, I really like that too. Later on, it was pointed out, but I'll just bring it up now. Andre talks about the way that the camera is frequently very high or very low, and that it does this interesting job of making you feel that detachment from reality without even realizing it.
Yeah.
I think that absolutely that's happening here as well.
Absolutely.
Mark clogs this other toilet with a shoe. Pukes into it with this feather, which I love the like so dramatic about it.
And it's like the skankiest looking feather from like a pile of garbage. It's so gross.
It sure is. Truly going into hell to get this. But he lures Heinrich in to bash his head with the tank, then sticks his head in the water to drown, sealing the frame job by sprinkling the psychedelics all over him. This is spy shit, baby.
Yeah. Whoa, he really took him out fast and efficient. Yeah.
Operation Explode My Wife's Crazy Trap House is in full effect.
The weird part is like, that's like, I feel like when he's leaving all of that is like the only moment in the movie where Mark seems genuinely happy and at ease.
Yeah. I mean, the only time he was happy was when he was working, basically.
Right?
When he was abandoning his family, and this is calling back to that. It is quite a fun pyrotechnic. They really get their money's worth on this one explosion that they have here.
Oh, it's good. And I love that there's some person just walking down the street, like, cackling.
She loves it. She's so stoked on this explosion. Her and Mark do, like, a little dance around each other, and then he speeds off on the bike. It's really fucking great.
Such a good scene.
Yeah. Margie has had her throat cut as Mark arrives back home. He is greeted with tears and affection from Anna. So I guess the plan is working. So this is where she treats him like a child to clean him up. It does mirror the way Bob was cleaned by Mark. It does create this idea of rebirth almost, I think, of him sort of creating a new foundation for himself in doing things for her. But she tells him God is in her and to take her. And so they have sex right there in the kitchen, although she is still looking pretty wild-eyed. And in the afterglow, they discuss Margie having to die for trying to take away her faith. It needs to be protected like a child. And then the actual child emerges from his slumber, which sends Anna running for the door.
Poor Bob. They really put Bob through it. Woo!
That's right. Yeah. After some more cleanup, including the body of Margie and a strange conversation with Heinrich's mother that reflects the one Anna had with Heinrich about the two sisters, Mark drops Bob off with Helen and heads to meet up with Anna, and he finds her having sex with the monstrosity. Anna created something from her loneliness, and she loves it for loving her the way she wants, nourishing her in a way that Mark does not. And so for Mark to see this, after having done this explosion for her, seems to drive him mad, or even madder, I guess, is more true to what the situation is.
And I love the way it's shot, you know, and it's another sort of, you know, cameras circling around and the movements of the monster. And it's not quite complete yet, but it's almost, you know, much more fully formed. And then she says, almost, almost, almost. And I'm like, almost orgasm, or the monster's almost
complete.
Done?
Yeah. You know, who knows? It's really good stuff. To throw it back to Irigaray real quick, there was an interesting connection point with the phallocentric perspective of the movie, where by deeming women's sexuality as monstrous, this then makes her loving the monster a homogenous act. It's an angelic opening, according to Irigaray, which means that when she says that God is in me, this is God. This is an angel, even if it is monstrous in form, that these two beings coming together in a way that is nourishing for both of them makes it an act of true love, an act of heaven.
And that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mark comes like the angel of death to Heinrich's mother. She is surrounded by crosses, which I thought was interesting. She still has her faith.
Mm-hmm.
And she does take a bunch of pills as they talk about souls and the simplicity of love. And when she dies, the window creaks open and the wind blows, like her soul leaving the body.
Mm-hmm.
That was a nice little touch there.
Mm-hmm. And he holds her hand.
Yeah.
Probably the nicest thing he does in that movie, except for the very rare moments that he's actually taking care of his child.
Yeah. And even that, like, that's expected. You should be doing that. Yeah, like, the hand-holding thing was like a genuine gesture. So I'm giving that the number one spot. Several more people are watching Mark from a tower across the Berlin Wall as one of the debriefers from earlier tries bringing him in from the cold, as they say. He doesn't really commit either way, but goes to rejoin Anna, finding her surrounded by the police. And he stages a distraction with a funny cabbie, and then there's a shootout where he gets hit several times before fleeing on the motorbike. I love this pretty long shot of him driving straight towards the camera and screaming, like, so primal. It's just a really great moment.
I also love when the car, the cabbie crashes, Margie's body just flies out of the trunk. It's just like, oh my God. It's such a great choreographed scene. There's so much going on, and it's just like, oh my God, this movie.
He does fall off the bike, and he gets kind of fucked up from it.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about this stunt being not only hella dangerous because of the concrete, but also he only had about 4 meters to pull it off, and mistiming it would have meant that he went in the water, which was East Berlin territory.
Oh,
so he
shit.
Probably would have been arrested if he had missed the timing.
Oh my goodness. That is buck wild.
Yeah. Talk about high stakes.
Yeah.
Mark runs to a church. There's a great shot of the stairs here spiraling themselves as he drags himself as high as he can, closer to God, some might say, in his own way. And Anna arrives with someone else in tow. What the fuck? It's a Mark doppelganger.
With those incredible eyes, is stunning. And scene when the monster is still being formed, they show the head up close, and it sort of looks straight at the camera, and you can see the eyes sort of, impressed a little bit. It's so creepy.
It really is. Just thinking about it is really gross, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
So the finished being, like I said, has taken his form. And I think that it is interesting that in her attempts to build something new, she has kind of recreated her old situation.
Don't we all?
Mark tries to shoot it, but before he can, both he and Anna are gunned down in a surprise hail of fire from the cops. And the Mark doppelganger watches curiously but unworried. And Anna drags herself to Mark for one last blood-soaked smooch before finishing the job herself, shooting herself through the back up against Mark.
Man, that must have been a difficult scene to shoot. I mean, even if you're really flexible, I feel like holding that gun to your own back like that just must have really been a difficult scene for her to shoot.
Yeah, yeah. So hard to live with it, eh, brother? The Mark doppelganger says. He convinces a young woman to shoot them, then helps him escape. But Mark himself is still kicking a little bit, and he throws himself over the balcony with the spy boss looking at the twisted corpse, sadly.
Unbelievable.
Yep. Back at the apartment, the doorbell is ringing, and Bob repeatedly asks Helen not to answer the door, where the doppelganger of his dad writhes behind the frosted glass. I thought it was really interesting that it's back to just Bob with his mom, with dad shut outside of the apartment.
Yep.
Things he wants, and he wants it this way. He don't open the door, he says. He wants things to go back to the way things were, which creates this interesting, like, parabolic structure for the movie.
Mm-hmm. And then Bob jumps in the tub face down.
Well, he sure does. Yeah, Helen goes to open the door, and Bob... I mean, I have to assume that he drowns himself.
It's so weird.
It's really bizarre. It is sort of a mirror image of his snorkeling earlier. Mm-hmm. And also his very first appearance is swimming around in the tub as well without a snorkel. The room darkens as sirens and the sound of explosions fill the air, with mm-hmm. Helen looking around in amazement.
And she looks kind of happy.
Yeah, yeah, she sure does. You know, destruction can breed creation, you know?
And do you think we're supposed to assume that is, you know, just bombing in that area, or just like complete destruction of the planet, you know?
Yeah, so Andre did talk about this. He said that in his mind, it is the start of a nuclear conflict, and it is an apocalyptic ending to him, one of multiple in his films. And he said that the reason is because he's a bit of a pessimist about the cyclical nature of things.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in the apocalypse of Poland in 1940, where his sister died of hunger and his parents mm-hmm. were the final members of a large family. You know, World War II decimated the entire continent of mm-hmm. Europe, and mm-hmm. and it's not an easy thing to grow up in, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to be pessimistic and see the worst in humanity is not insanely hard to believe, I
guess. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of makes the most logical sense.
Yeah. And so at the end, both parents have been replaced by pod people, these perfect versions of themselves. And Bob, he knows, he sees all, as Helen said earlier. And so he goes and kills himself, I guess.
Oh my God.
Poor Bob.
So dark. Poor little Bob. I want to give him a hug.
And now, Corinne, we've reached the part of the episode where we sum up why it's not just a good horror movie, but is in fact the best horror movie ever made. And I'm going to let you start.
I think it's the best horror movie ever made because of everything we just discussed. Two of the best performances in any genre of movie, in my personal opinion, ever. It's poetic. It lacks logic. It's also based in logic. The cinematography is out of this world, oozing, disgusting, horrific monsters like you've never seen. I just think it's the best.
Hell yeah. To me, this is the best horror movie ever made because not only is it incredible on a technical standpoint, where, yes, these performances are incredible. The cinematography, fantastic. The minimalist score, top-notch. But also, I love that it doesn't really have a universal morality.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of gray in the way that these characters are hurt people hurting people.
Mm-hmm.
And it all of those intricacies of being turned into a ghost by the roles that you play and looking for someone to meet you where you're at is just so powerful. It really is. And it's a theme that doesn't get explored a ton. And when it does, it if it's done right, it's just so impactful. Solaris is one of my favorite movies. This is a beautiful mirror image to it. And like I said, the fact that it is grounded in that male perspective, but still doesn't have to stay that way.
Mm-hmm.
That it can be brought into your own thinking in a way that can encourage heterosexual women to embrace their differences from men rather than be subsumed by it. And to see Anna as a strong character who mm-hmm. is finding this agency. And yes, she is being destructive. And yes, she is hurting people. But she's doing that because she wants to, and because mm-hmm. it is making her feel a little bit of power in her life. It's just really fantastic. Isabelle Adjani is incredible in it. I mean, truly
genius.
One of the most iconic and powerful performances in movies, not just horror.
Exactly. It's, 1,000% agree.
It's incredible. And that's why this is the best horror movie ever made.
Yes.
Woo. Corinne, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. This was an absolute blast. Please tell the people where they can find your work, any plugs that you want to tell them. Now's the chance.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. This was fantastic. I had such a good time. I am most active on Instagram, and I also have a website you can check out. And I do everything, you know, with my name, which is just Corinne Halbert, which is CorinneHalbert. My book, Acid Nun, was published in 2022 by Silver Sprocket. You can get it on their website or get in touch with your local book, you know, small press book or comic shops. to see if they carry it so you can go pick it up in person. I make paintings that I sell within the United States on my Big Cartel page. And yeah, that's where you can find my stuff.
Check it out. Corinne's work is incredible, like I said at the beginning. Some really fantastic surreal work from her as well. It's really fantastic. Lots of bright colors, which I love. It's just great. So definitely check that out.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As far as my plugs, people can find me. Oh, I'm actually not on Twitter anymore. How about that? I was about to find me on Twitter, but I have officially pretty much stopped posting on there because, boy, it's just a nightmare. Mm-hmm. So find me on Instagram or Letterboxd, that little horror PHL. You can also check out the Patreon if you're really enjoying the show, where we do all kinds of bonus episodes, not only spotlights of other horror movies, but also things that don't necessarily fit, like we've done some rankings of our top animated horror shorts from 1929 to 1953 with Branson Reese. So yeah, if that sounds appealing to people, sign up for the Patreon.
Awesome.
You can also, we have a live show. How about that? There's a live show coming up May 4th. If you're in Philadelphia and you want to come see a live episode, Paul Ritchie from Continue is will be screening first Tetsuo the Iron Man. Very fun movie. And it's nice and short, which means that we have plenty of time to screen it, take a short break, and then do a live episode about it. So I'm very, very excited. It's my favorite venue in Philadelphia, Philomoca, literally built into a mausoleum showroom. So it is a perfect spot to bring the best horror movie ever made to the people live. So check that out at philomoca.com. You can find us there May 4th.
Boom. So cool.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very excited about it.
That movie rocks.
Oh, I love it so much. It's so, the mania in it, like the fast-paced editing is just so incredible. And it's funny that it really is sort of like on the opposite end of the spectrum of this in a lot of ways, in that it is very short and it's very frenetic and it's black and white, but a lot of the same sort of like agency and like, who am I as a person and transformation happening to people, like a lot of similar themes that do come up. So definitely want to see people check that out. And even if you don't come to the live show, check out Tetsuo because it fucking rules.
Totally.
All right. Thanks, everyone. That's it. Bye.
Thank you.